A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Dave and DeGenevieve, a new conversation.
All right, here we go.
On KSL News Radio, 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
We're going to spend the majority of our 10 o'clock hour on this show talking about a very important story that aired last night on KSL television. And it involves a journey that has enveloped my co-host's family for decades, since 1990. And all of us have a very personal journey that we never asked for. Some of you have had cancer. Some of you have had loved ones involved in a devastating auto crash. You don't know why. You didn't ask for this. Well, Dave's journey is personally like none other I've ever heard before. The cold-blooded murder of his aunt, his grandmother, the kidnapping of his cousins, the shooting of his uncle. In a moment, we're going to explain in a lot more detail about why this is a topic of a very important discussion that we're going to have today. For now, though, Dave, as difficult as it is, I want you to tell us about what happened.
This is a story, as you said, that has really tortured our family for 30 years. And I'll give a little ears warning here as I describe what happened. And the reason I'm going to describe it, and I'll give some detail, is because it's important, I think, to understand the horrific nature of these murders and how it's impacted us. So if you have little kids in the car, this is definitely not the segment for them to hear. So go ahead and turn it down and podcast this later if you would like. But yeah, you talked about the story. This was days before Christmas in 1990. Just a couple days, my parents were out Christmas shopping, and I got a phone call from my uncle, and he's like, "Dave, where's your parents? I got to talk to them." And I'm like, "They're out shopping," and throughout the day, for several hours, he just kept calling back and saying, "I've got to talk to your parents. I got to talk to your parents." And I didn't really think of anything. When they got home, we found out that my aunt and my grandma had been killed, and we started finding out how this happened. They're from Texas. My aunt Kay was from Texas, but they had a cabin up here that they built, and they would come every winter.
If I remember correctly, that was like east of Salt Lake City in the Oakley area.
Yeah, in Oakley.
Yeah,
yep.
Beautiful area.
Yeah, Oakley, Camas area. And anyway, they would spend a lot of time up at the cabin. Well, these two criminals that were in a halfway house at the time had gone up into these cabins and had been breaking into them and stealing. And when they got to my aunt's cabin, my mom's sister, they were best friends, they break into the cabin, and nobody's home, but they just stay in the cabin, and they sit down, and they start going through the Christmas presents. And they grab the family video camera and they start recording themselves, opening up the Christmas presents and laughing and joking about how we're going to wait for these people to arrive. And then my aunt and my grandma and my cousins, my two cousins, they arrive at the cabin. And these men, they take them hostage. They shoot and kill my grandma and my aunt, in front of my two cousins. And my uncle hadn't arrived yet. Well, he was shortly behind them. So he arrives, and as he's coming into the house, these two men, they go out. I'm trying to remember which is which, but it doesn't really matter. I lumped them all together, right? They're both guilty. They shoot Uncle Rolf. They douse him in gasoline, and they set him on fire. They kidnap my two cousins, and they speed away. My uncle was not dead. He pretended to be dead as they were leaving, as they were kidnapping his daughters. He jumps on a snowmobile, having been shot and burned, and he chases them on a snowmobile until he gets to the main road, and his brother, fortunately, happens to be there. And his brother has a cell phone, and back in the 90s, you know, no one had cell phones, but he had a cell phone. They call 911. They tell him what's happened, and every police officer, and if you wonder sometimes why I have such a feeling for police officers and why I love police officers so much, every police officer, undercover, not working, it didn't matter. Everybody shows up. Everybody shows up to find these girls. As they're chasing them down the canyon, they end up spinning out off the side of the road, and there's an exchange of gunfire. Nobody gets hit. Nobody dies. My two cousins, they are crouched down and hiding in the back of the car as bullets are flying all around. Again, nobody gets hit. These two men get arrested. We go through the trial. Both found guilty. One pleads guilty. One gets the death penalty. And for the last 30 years, we have been dealing and having this story pop up. It happens, I don't know, every few years.
Because of appeals.
There's a new appeals. There's a new argument. There's a new case. There's legislation that is looking to abolish the death penalty. Whatever it is, I can tell you my family, just about every year for the past 30 years, gets dragged into some sort of hearing or some sort of we get asked for interviews, and we have to retell this story. And it's a brutal story, and it's a scab that will not heal.
It's a life sentence for you and your family.
It has been, and it has been. And I can tell you, it's I was 14 years old at the time, maybe a little younger, and it still impacts me. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget the moment that my dad had to tell my mom in front of all of us of what had happened, because there's no way to do it other than just to tell the brutal, honest truth. And that's the story that we've been dealing with.
Every time you tell that story, and I hate the fact that we have to retell it, I hate the fact that this ever happened to your family and to your grandma, your aunt, your cousins, your uncle, and to you. I appreciate that you are willing to share that and be very, very open and candid. Now, until KSL Television and their investigative team and our very own Cold Podcast investigative reporter, Dave Cowley, started looking into this issue about death row no longer being death row at the Utah State Prison, did you have any clue at all that death row inmates at the Utah State Prison have been shifted under a new prison policy to medium security, where they get all kinds of privileges that they do not receive on death row? Did you know that it happened?
Absolute shocker to us. We had absolutely no idea.
You found out how?
Dave Cowley called me up, and he said, Dave, we're working on this story. I wanted to know if you were aware of what's going on. And at first, I kind of dismissed what he was saying, because I'm like, yeah, Dave, we deal with this all the time. I know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, Dave, listen. They've basically gotten rid of death row. So the man that murdered your family is now in medium security. And I didn't even know how to react. Because, again, it's always something with this story. And I want to know why. I want to know how this happened. And I want to know why we had no idea. Why wouldn't the Department of Corrections talk to the victims and say, hey, we're thinking about this. What do you think? They had no input from us. No interest. And there are not very many people on death row. You could literally reach out to all the victims' families.
Seven.
In very short order.
Seven. Dave, for you and for the victims' families, let's ask Cold Podcast investigative reporter Dave Colley those very questions about how he discovered a secret policy, and I'll call it a secret policy, that allows death row inmates to work their way off death row. Next.
Dave and Dejanovic.
Decades ago, there was a grandma. She was not quite 50 years old. Her name was Claudia Ben. She was at home with her grandkids. I think she was babysitting them even. When her daughter's ex-boyfriend broke into her home, I'm going to be graphic here, parents. Once again, remind you to turn down the audio if you have little ears in the car or nearby. He breaks into her home, he slits her throat, and he kills her. A judge in Utah sentenced him to death, saying, quote, if this isn't a death penalty case, I don't know what is. Well, we just learned, thanks to the investigative reporting work here at KSL Television and also with the excellent reporting by Cold Podcast investigative reporter Dave Colley, that death row in Utah no longer means death row. That years ago, there was this policy change. Dave Noriega, you just told your family story. Did you know that death row no longer means death row in Utah?
We had no idea. Absolutely no idea. We were just smacked across the face with this knowledge. And Debbie, as I shared that story of my grandma and my aunt being murdered, it's a story I don't talk about very often. In the years that we've done this show, I think I've talked about it twice. So it's not something that I like to dwell on. It's not something I even like to talk about. But there's times, I think, that we need to remember that the focus so often is on the murderer and not the victims and not the victims' families and how it impacts them. And we should always remember the victims, because that's the true tragedy, is the people that were murdered and the people that have to live with the aftermath.
Dave Colley joining us right now in this is a very, very difficult conversation. In a moment, I'm going to ask you how you discovered this. Mm-hmm. And it was almost by fluke, because the prison had not made any sort of public announcement. Dave Noriega, his family didn't know that this had happened. Now, you teamed up with the KSL Television Investigative Unit, reporter Mike Hedrick, breaking the story on TV last night. Mm-hmm. And Mike sat down with the son of yet another murder victim, Maureen Hunsaker, who was killed at the hands of her kidnapper decades ago. Let's get more from Mike Hedrick about this policy none of us on the outside knew about, called Last Chance.
A last chance policy, a policy that's been in effect for more than 15 years now, a policy most people haven't even heard of, and a policy the Department of Corrections won't even show us.
They don't want you to know nothing, because obviously they didn't tell anybody this. It's not been announced. The policy wasn't announced. It wasn't a formal thing.
The KSL investigators filed a public records request asking the prison for a copy of the last chance policy. Well, here's the answer we got. Access to the record denied because it was, quote, protected.
It's not right. It's not right for me and the family.
Matt Hunsaker says the only reason he found out that Ralph Menzies had been moved to medium security is because he heard it from us. Since then, he's tried to get answers, but says the Department of Corrections is not being forthcoming with him either.
What's the big question you want answered?
Why? Why now?
Dave Colley joins us, and Dave, you're the one that broke the news to me as well. And I truly appreciate you digging into this because it was hard to hear this. First of all, has the Department of Corrections ever talked about this or gone on the record and discussed this policy?
Not that I'm aware of. I can tell you what happened was we obviously have been for the last more than a year looking at the Joyce Yost Doug Lovell murder. He is one of these seven death row inmates in Utah. And as part of that, there was some correspondence, writing letters back and forth, and also just generally keeping tabs. The Department of Corrections has a website where you can look up any person who is currently at the prison and see where they are housed. And for these death row inmates, as long as anyone can remember, it has been Uinta, the maximum security facility. And within just the last number of months, I noticed Doug Lovell was no longer in Uinta. And at the time, you know, COVID was going on. The thought was maybe there was a medical thing going on. But then we started looking up the others, right? And in your case, Dave, noticing Von Taylor, well, he's out of Max. Okay.
Which is death row.
Why? Why? And that was the question. So we sat down with the new, recently installed corrections director, Brian Nielsen, and asked him. And that's basically what he said is, well, it's this policy.
And they can work their way through last chance out of death row?
So they still have their death sentence, but conceptually, if you think about, you know, these are supposed to be the most dangerous, the most notorious. These are people who are slated to die at the hands of the state. They have no pathway forward without having their convictions overturned. So the thinking for decades has been you lock them up in maximum security and that's where they stay until they're executed. And that's what's changed.
I want to ask you the difference between maximum security, Uinta 1, and not death row,
right.
Medium security, where they're now a lot of these individuals are now housed. Do they get special privileges that they wouldn't get if they were sitting in maximum security?
Yeah, absolutely. So maximum security, think of it as being you are all alone in your one cell and you get out anywhere from maybe an hour to a few hours per day. You're always in this world of concrete. Even when you go out to the quote-unquote yard, it's a tiny little space with, you know, a chain-link fence over your head. You are never out with more than, like, one other inmate at a time. Anytime you leave that unit, you have to be shackled hands and feet, and you are escorted by SWAT, right? I mean, they treat you like the most dangerous. Contrast that with medium security. It will vary in medium security what your privileges are, but now you're talking about access to, you know, computer lab, to library, more recreation, to the chapel. You can potentially, you know, eat meals with other people as opposed to just eating alone in your cell. So think of it as like networking opportunity for these death row inmates that they've not had for decades.
Dave, as I listen to you describe this, it makes me realize how harsh death row is. And as you describe that, there is no question that that is a harsh punishment. And to think this happened to my family, you know, 30 years ago, that would be a long time to live like that. I understand that. I'm not unsympathetic to how brutal that is. But you have to remember these victims, you know, and Debbie, you just mentioned a few. My aunt was in her 40s, you know, her late 40s. She was a very young woman. She had she had teenagers. As bad as prison is, it's not dead. And that's what so many of these men are. They're all there for that. They're all there for murder. And it's not just murder. It's premeditated murder.
Dave, did you get any sort of indication at all that the prison is going to rethink this policy?
You know, the corrections director told us that they are in the process of reviewing currently their typical classification system, how they, you know, determine where inmates are housed. But because they won't let us see that last chance policy,
won't give it to you.
We don't know what's there.
They say it's protected?
Right.
Why?
So if you look at the section of the Utah Open Records Law, basically what they said is it could interfere with investigations or audits. That's the bottom line. We're going to challenge that.
Good.
Because personally, I think that's a rather weak argument.
Well, I think Dave Noriega, Dave's mom, Dave's family, the Hunsakers, Joyce Yost's family, on and on, Claudia Ben's family, they all deserve to see that policy for themselves. And they also deserved a phone call at the very least from the prison. I know we're so tight on time here, but did you get any information out of the prison at all as to why they didn't contact Dave Noriega and so many other victims' families?
No, and the Department of Corrections, to be clear, they do have discretion about how they handle these inmates. And so the point of our story is, okay, be transparent about it. And especially for these victims, have the decency to let them know that the policy has changed. Don't just make it quietly and not tell anybody.
Dave Colley, thank you so much for your work. I know you uncover a lot of ugly things. This is one of those ugly things. So thank you for your work.
We cannot let this discussion go just yet. Next, we're going to peel back another layer to this shifting of death row inmates to medium security at the Utah State Prison and discuss why Utah law says this is perfectly okay.
Dave and Dejanovic.
I think Maureen Hunsaker's son Matt said it best when he spoke to KSL Television. This is how we expect the prison treats death row inmates, like the man who murdered Matt's mom.
He deliberately took her up to the mountains. He deliberately tied her to a tree, and he deliberately slit her throat.
For nearly 35 years since Maureen Hunsaker's death, the man who murdered her has been sitting on death row. Or at least that's what everyone thought, including Matt.
I want him locked up 24 hours a day. They slide the food in and out. They'll hose him down with the shower. He shouldn't have anything. This is a punishment.
Thanks to the work of our colleagues here at KSL Television and also Cold Podcast investigative reporter Dave Colley, we found out that death row inmates aren't on death row. And Dave, this includes the man who murdered your grandma, your aunt, kidnapped your cousins, and set your uncle on fire after they shot him.
Yeah. It's weird to hear grandma and aunt because it was Grams. And it was Aunt Kay. And I do find myself sometimes speaking almost clinically about what happened to our family because it's hard to stir up those emotions again.
I'm sorry.
But I do it occasionally. I don't do it very often. But when I hear a story that really bothers me or something comes up in the news, my family will talk occasionally about the tragedy. It's hard to do because it rips off a scab.
Mm-hmm.
We've tried to heal it for 30 years. It just seems like it's a conspiracy. Every time it starts to heal, something comes up, a new appeals, a new judgment, a new ruling, this, and it makes it difficult.
They moved him from, and others, on death row, maximum security, to medium security, where they get a lot more privileges, and it was done out of public view. I want to say quietly, Dave, you and other victims' families had no clue that this had happened.
No.
No.
I had no idea the Department of Corrections had such leeway. They were tried, they were convicted, they were sentenced. And then it seems at some point the Department of Corrections gets to step in and say, nah, I think that punishment's too harsh. Let's ease it up a little bit.
Greg Skordas, a former prosecutor, now a defense attorney. Are you shocked, like so many of us are, that death row really isn't death row anymore at the Utah State Prison?
I'm really not, Debbie. And I can't even imagine the grief that Dave and his family have gone through. But the Department of Corrections still has this man incarcerated. He's still in prison. He's still not free to leave or to go anywhere. He may have slightly more time out in the yard than they may want, but he's not going anywhere. And I think we do try to give our corrections departments a little bit of leeway in housing inmates in a way that is safe for other inmates and sort of alleviates the crowdedness in certain parts of the prison.
Greg, I think one of the things that bothers victims' families is the lack of transparency, not asking us or looking for any input of what it would mean. And also, I think what worries us is the trend. Is it this step now? Is it medium security and then even better behavior moves you up even to a lesser security? At what point do, and there's not many people on death row, but at what point do we say, you know what, if we're drawing a line, the death row inmates, the people that have a death sentence, they're probably the scariest.
Yeah, and I do think, Dave, that it would have been appropriate from the Department of Corrections standpoint to have notified the victim's family that there was this movement. I mean, certainly they absolutely have to notify you of parole hearings, of parole dates, sentencing, appeal information, but where the individual is housed in which unit of the prison isn't that, I guess it's not that, I hate to use the word important because it's incredibly important, but it's not the type of thing that maybe the prison takes as seriously as those other matters. And like I said, he's not going anywhere, and he's still incarcerated, yet, just in a different unit, different part of the prison system than perhaps you and the family would like.
Well, Greg, I personally think that Utah law is squarely ultimately to blame for this because of the way it is set up. Judges, announce their sentence. In this case, they sentenced seven individual men to death, and then they turn custody over to the Department of Corrections, the Board of Pardons, and whatever happens to them, happens to them. And I think that's all because of how we've set up the process here in Utah under the law.
You're exactly right, Debbie. I mean, that's the way it works. Even on misdemeanor cases, when we house individuals in our county jails, the judge can say, go to jail for 90 days. But the sheriff that operates the jail decides how much of those 90 days the individual will ultimately serve. And it's the same in the state system. The judge can sentence someone to 5 years to life in the Utah State Penitentiary. But it's up to the Department of Corrections what five to life means to decide whether it's 6 years, whether it's 25 years, and all points in between. So we do give our corrections department some leeway in that respect, but it's because they operate, they have to run the facility, and they have their own rules and regulations on what they can do and how crowded a place can be, and to frankly reward inmates who do well, who stay out of trouble, who toe the line.
Greg Skordas, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a conversation for the past 45 minutes, and we appreciate you chiming in.
It's time to step away from it now, Dave. Give you a break. Thank you once again for sharing your family story. I want you to get up, take a walk around the block of Mom's house.
But you have to be back in 3 minutes because that's when the break ends.
The 3 minutes because we're going to talk about voting. You know, the Senate is voting on a bill today. We expect them to overhaul the elections process here in the United States. But straight ahead, we want to know, how do you vote? Do you vote by mail? Do you vote in person? We're going to take your texts on this one, 57500. Vote by text on this one, 57500. Weigh in. Next.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow the letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.